If you would turn with me to Luke chapter 5, we'll be continuing our series through the Gospel of Luke. Luke is known for its parables. Luke is rich with parables. I'm looking forward to getting into those as we go through the Gospel. And actually in chapter 5, we come across the very first parable that's recorded in Luke. And it's one that baffled me for a long time. I remember going to my grandfather's house when I was in college, my dad's dad, who was a preacher, and sitting on the back porch and saying, "I don't understand this parable," and discussing it with him. I wish I could remember exactly what he said. I wish we could talk about it again now, but maybe one day. So Luke chapter 5, beginning in verse 36. He also told them a parable. No one tears a piece from a new garment and puts it on an old garment. If he does, he will tear the new, and the piece from the new will not match the old. And no one puts new wine in old wineskins. If he does, the new wine will burst the skins, and it will be spilled, and the skins will be destroyed. But new wine must be put into fresh wineskins. And no one, after drinking old wine, desires new, for he says, the old is good. Many of the descriptions of the parable here might be a little foreign to us in terms of the imagery he's using. We'll get to that in a little bit. But even understanding the general word picture, to me, the more challenging thing is, what is Jesus getting at? I mean, what is this parable teaching us? What is he saying by this? And what is the meaning that we're to get? And I do believe that we can come to an understanding of that. And the context is really, as always, the best place to go for an understanding of any passage of Scripture. So we'll begin by looking at the context, kind of setting up the what's going on, what prompted this parable. And when we see that, I believe that the meaning of it will become clear. So backing up, last time we got to, as we were looking at the authority of Jesus' word and how people and things, demons, diseases, other people responded to that authority, we ended with the call of Matthew, who's referred to by his other name, Levi, in Luke's gospel in verse 27. After this, he went out and saw a tax collector named Levi sitting at the tax booth, and he said to him, "Follow me," and leaving everything, he rose and followed him. It's worth mentioning, I think, as we go along, that this would have been a controversial pick for a disciple, and especially for one who would become an ambassador, an apostle who would be sent out, because tax collectors were generally despised in those days. They were seen by the Jews as, at best, kind of traitors because they worked with the occupying force, the Romans, and they were also tended to be corrupt in their business. And so people normally had a very low regard for tax collectors. And so for Jesus, if you think about it, he's assembling kind of an A-team. He's putting together a group that he's going to mentor and then send out into the community, send out into the world to carry. And, you know, just looking for things to point out and tear down. But it's interesting, they go indirectly, they go to the disciples. I mean, they could have just asked Jesus, and they do it sometimes, just challenge Jesus. But at this point, they're just going around kind of behind his back, saying to the people who are listening to him, like, why are you doing this? But even though they go behind him to talk to the disciples with their complaint, in verse 31, it tells that Jesus answered them. So they're trying to take pot shots and ask these questions to his followers, but Jesus just answers them directly. And his answer is interesting because he doesn't disagree with their assessment of the tax collectors. He doesn't say, "Oh, you've got it all wrong. These are great people. These are good guys. You're mistaken. There's nothing wrong." No, he doesn't deny that he's eating with sinners. In fact, he says that the reason that I'm here with them is the same reason you'd find a doctor in the middle of a bunch of sick folks, because that's their job, to work with the sick folks. And it's his job to be here with the sinners. Now, the irony in all this is that those Pharisees did the physician as much as the tax collectors. They just didn't see it. They didn't know it. So they thought of those people who are sinners, and why are you with those people? But Jesus came with the cure, and their illness was just as in need of that cure. It was just buried deep in their heart, and it would be difficult for it to come to light and painful for them to be able to see that. But that's why Jesus is sitting with these people, as he says. But this isn't going to time that they complain and nitpick. In fact, it goes on in verse 33, getting closer to our parable. They say to him, the disciples of John fast often and offer prayers. So the disciples of the Pharisees, but yours eat and drink. So it's this question about fasting and praying that prompts the parable about the patches and the wineskins. And so it's worth, I think, taking some time to understand what it is that they're saying. Why is this the criticism? What is it that they're getting at? Well, the challenge is, there's these other spiritual leaders. The Pharisees have their followers. The Pharisees were seen as, guides, leaders, religious, people that knew what they were doing. So they had their followers. And John had been recognized as a prophet, at least at times, when they felt like it, they could appeal to John. So in this case, they're appealing to John and saying, look, even John. So you have John, he's the leader, and you have the Pharisees, they're leaders. Look at all their disciples. What do? They're fasting and praying, but your disciples are not doing that. So why are your disciples not fasting and praying like theirs were? So to understand a little bit as a reminder about fasting, if you look through the scriptures, fasting is done from cover to cover, basically. It was a prominent part of the life of believers in the Old Testament and in the church, in the New Testament. But it was very often associated with times of grief, times of mourning, times of repentance, a time of very serious and earnest prayer. Fasting and prayer often go hand in hand together. And people would be fasting when they were praying to God for deliverance, when they were praying to God for forgiveness. That would be times that you would find people fasting. And of course, there's nothing wrong with fasting. It's something that is kind of expected. But for many people, to go over to Matthew chapter 6. We'll come back here, of course, but let's go to Matthew chapter 6. For many of the Jews, their fasting had become a sign of piety. It was something you could do to show other people that you're serious, that you're a righteous person. And unfortunately, they did this with a lot of their religion. And Jesus is calling them out for that. And he says in verse 7 of Matthew 6, when you pray, don't heap up empty phrases like the Gentiles do. And I meant to start in verse 5. When you pray, you must not be like the hypocrites, for they love to stand and pray in the synagogues, at the street corners, that they may be seen by others. Truly, I say to you, they have received their reward. So this is all within the theme of verse 1, where he says, don't practice your righteousness to be seen by others. But they would pray to be seen by others. They would give to be seen by others. And then skipping down to verse 16, when you fast, do not look gloomy like the hypocrites, for they disfigure their faces, and that their fasting may be seen by others. Truly, I say to you, they have received their reward. But when you fast, anoint your head, wash your face, that your fasting may not be seen by others, but by your Father who is in secret. Your Father who sees in secret will reward you. So they had this idea that fasting was a good thing, something that a holy or righteous person would do. And if I'm fasting and you can't tell I'm fasting, then how are you going to be proud of me? And how are you going to think highly of me? You know, if that's the whole point of my religion, is to impress you with how righteous I am, well, then I need to make sure you can tell I'm fasting. So they would just, you see this guy. He looks like, oh, he's fasting. You're fasting today? Oh, yes, I'm fasting today. Oh, he's such a righteous man. You do this twice a week. So you remember the parable in the account in Luke 18. Jesus said two men went up to pray, the publican, the tax collector, and the Pharisee. And the Pharisee standing far off, lifted up his eyes and said, aren't you glad I'm not like other people, not like that guy? And he said, I fast twice a week. I give alms of all that I have. So they kind of use this as a status of, well, I know that I'm a righteous person because I fast twice a week. And everybody would be able to see that, of course. They could tell that I'm fasting and I'm really doing all the right things. That's how you know I'm a good guy, all right? Because you can see this. You can tell that I'm one of those people that fast twice a week. And so they were doing all these things to be seen by others. That was part of their problem. But then imagine that when they come to Jesus and they see his disciples, they're not doing any of the things that you're supposed to do. They're not doing the stuff that lets everybody know that you're a righteous person. You watch the disciples of the Pharisees, you watch the disciples of John, and you can just tell that they're good people, because look at them, they're fasting all the time and praying, and Jesus' disciples, we don't see that. So what's wrong with your disciples? And this would just be one of several things. Go to Matthew chapter 15. Some of them were very trivial. But in Matthew 15, beginning verse 1, the Pharisees and scribes came to Jesus from Jerusalem and said, "Why do your disciples break the tradition of the elders, for they do not wash their hands when they eat?" Now notice that it says that they came from Jerusalem in verse 1. And the previous verses, in verse 34 of the previous chapter, shows that they were up in Galilee on the Lake Gennesaret, the Sea of Galilee. And it continues in there. So Jesus is up there in Galilee, and they come with a delegation of, you know, the leaders of the Jews. And they make their way all the way up there to find Jesus to say, "Why are you not washing your hands? Why are your people, your disciples, are not washing their hands before they eat?" Now, it wasn't that they were concerned that they might get sick, or that they were, you know, they didn't, I don't even think they understood all that about, like, modern concepts of germs and that kind of stuff. But the problem is that they were not keeping the, notice what it says? They do not keep the tradition of the elders. Like, we have a long-standing practice that goes back, way back. And here's what we do. Jewish people that know what's right and wrong wash their hands when they eat, right? That's what we do. And your disciples are not doing that. Bunch of heathens. Bunch of, you know, mongrels. You guys, just look at you. You're not doing it right. And so their general complaint is, and you can tell they're not coming right out and saying it, but it's obvious that they're accusing Jesus of not being a very good teacher. Because Jesus is the leader. These people are following Jesus. But just look at them. They're not doing the right things. They don't wash when they eat. They're not fasting like we're supposed to fast. They're not doing these things that the other disciples do. So what's wrong with Jesus, and why are his disciples not doing these things? Not only that, back in Luke chapter 6, it's not just that they're not fasting. But in Luke, back in our passage, Luke chapter 5, sorry. They say in verse 33, "The disciples of John fast often and offer prayer, so the disciples of Pharisees, but yours eat and drink." So not only are they not fasting, they're eating and drinking. Well, everybody eats and drinks. I mean, you have to live. But I think what they mean by that is not just any old eating and drinking, but basically they're living it up. They're having a grand old time. In fact, turn over a couple of chapters to chapter 7 of Luke. This particular charge would become even more slanderous about Jesus. In verse 33 of chapter 7, he says, talking about to them, he says, "For John the Baptist came eating and no bread and drinking no wine, and you say he had a demon. The Son of Man has come eating and drinking, and you say, 'Look at him, a glutton and a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors and sinners.'" So it's true that John fasted, and John's disciples apparently fasted as well. Jesus, on the other hand, was not fasting, and his disciples were not fasting, but instead they were eating and drinking. But they were eating and drinking in a way that brought about this charge that they were slanderously accusing him of eating, you know, overdoing it. So it must have been really, you know, here's the perplexing thing to the Pharisees. They got in their minds this picture of a righteous person. Here's how, you know, you can tell when you're doing it right. Number one, your hands are always clean when you eat. But number two, you fast, like, regularly. And you afflict yourself. And you're somber and you pray. But then they look over and here's Jesus. And he's undeniably something, because he's teaching, he's doing miracles, and people are flocking to him. But his followers are not doing it right. His followers are just, look at them, they're just like eating and drinking, and they're... And not only that, it's a bunch of sinners, there's tax collectors just sitting there having a good time. And this is not how this is supposed to be done. That's their complaint, right? You're not doing it right, is what I think they're saying. So then Jesus responds, and this leads up to our parable for today. But let's look at, first of all, he makes an instruction in verse 34, back in chapter 6. Or is it chapter 5? 5. Chapter 5, verse 34. Jesus says, "Can you make wedding guests fast while the bridegroom is with them? The days will come when the bridegroom is taken away from them, and then they will fast in those days. So first of all, Jesus says this is not the appropriate occasion for fasting. So if you recall that fasting was normally done in a somber kind of, you know, grieving, mourning, repenting context, Jesus says this is an occasion for rejoicing and celebrating. Compare it to a wedding. If you had invited people to a wedding and you prepared a big spread and it's a happy day, it's a joyous day, it's a day for celebrating, and you wouldn't expect people at the wedding party to be sitting over there at the table and they're fasting and they're sad and they're all down and out. That's not the occasion. This is an occasion for joy. And in the same way, he's saying that he is the bridegroom and he's with them. And while he is with his followers, they're rejoicing in the same way that a wedding party is rejoicing at leading up to the wedding. This is an occasion for rejoicing. It's not a time for mourning. There would be a time for mourning when he's taken away. There will be days yet to come when it would be somber, when it would be sad, when they would be grieving and they would be praying and they would be fasting. Those days are coming, but it's not now because he's with them. And so the reason these people are happy, you know, the whole problem is the Pharisees are so upset. They look over and they see everybody's just having a good time. The reason they're happy is because Jesus is with them. They have the Lord in their midst, the one who was foretold. And so they're rejoicing as is appropriate. The Pharisees don't get that. Number one, because they don't understand or believe that Jesus is the Messiah. So they're not even on the same page about all that. But also they're blinded by their preconception about how things are supposed to be. So they don't understand why Jesus and his followers are eating and drinking and basically having a grand old time, it appears. Now, he comes to the parable, verse 36. He also told them a parable. No one tears a piece from a new garment and puts it on an old garment. If he does, he will tear the new. The piece from the new will not match the old. And no one puts new wine into old wineskins. If he does, the new wine will burst the skins and it will be spilled. The skins will be destroyed. But new wine must be put into fresh wineskins. And no one, after drinking old wine, desires new, for he says, the old is good. Okay. So this parable is based on three facts that were well known to them, but may or may not be well known to us, depending on your age and experiences. One of them is that people used to patch stuff when it ripped. So that's probably a foreign concept to a lot of people here who are younger, but I actually can remember mom having patches on my jeans when I would go to school. You know, the knees would always rip, and Mom, now, the ones I recall mom having, you would iron on. Does anybody remember those days? So that was that puts me in that age bracket of the iron-on blue jean patches. But so number one, they used to patch stuff, and you just don't see that as much as you used to. Number two, this was in a time when, and this was even when I was a kid, this is also kind of foreign now, but stuff used to shrink really badly. I remember having to buy things that were baggy and too long because you knew after it went through the washing machine, it would not be as big anymore. So you had to get stuff larger than you needed because it was always going to shrink. And I think a lot of stuff is like pre-shrunk, and it's also synthetics and it's nylons and it's other stuff like that. So that's not as big of a problem as it used to be. It seems like now if you take the kids shopping and they try it on, it fits. You might want to be a little big so they can grow into it, but you don't have to worry that after one trip through the washing cycle, it's going to be, like, smaller. I guess it still happens, but not as commonly. So those two things. They used to patch stuff. Stuff shrinks. Leads to this idea of the parable, which is if you have an old, worn-out pair of jeans that have been washed a bunch of times and you get some brand-new now, not that they were wearing jeans, but that's, you know. If you get some new denim and you stitch that brand new denim onto it, that's going to be fine until it goes through the wash, and then what's going to happen? The little patch part's going to shrink, and it's going to rip the old worn-out jeans. So that's parable number one. Parable number two, the imagery is also something that's probably foreign to most of us, which is part of the winemaking process. They used to take the wine and store it in skins. This is just a leather bag. As I understand it, they could take like a lamb or a goat or something and actually skin it, scrape the, you know, all the stuff off the, like if you were tanning leather, turn it inside out, stitch it up, and you make like a bag, kind of funny looking bag, but it's a bag made out of a skin of an animal. And then you could pour stuff in there and keep it in there. And, you know, there's still leather bags. I mean, you can still do that, but it's not something we have any experience with. But as they would put this, they would take a new skin, and you put the wine in it. And then as it would, the new wine goes in the new skin, there was a, during the process of fermentation, it creates gas and it expands. But the brand new skin, being new, soft, supple, would expand with it, and the whole thing would kind of contain this, what you've got there. But over time, it would become hardened and stretched and, you know, tight. And then it could only do that once. It could never do that again. So if you then poured the wine out and put brand new wine in and tried to reuse that, you know, you're trying to be frugal. So you've got an old wineskin. If you put new wine in there, it would stretch. But now it can't. The old skin is tanned and hard, and it can't do it again, so it would break. So you have to put the new wine in the new wineskins. That's how I understand what he's saying there in that part of the parable. Still haven't answered the question about fasting. We'll get to that in a second. And then the third thing he says is, everybody prefers the old stuff. No one, after having old wine, asks for new, because he says the old is better. And that's just based on general knowledge that people prefer aged, older wine to newer wine. So, those are the three pictures, which again may or may not be familiar to us, depending on your experiences. But that's what he's saying. But how does all this apply to this question about fasting? That's the harder part to me. But I think that the answer is that he is saying, so let's just think about this. What is the wine and what is the wine skins? It looks to me like Jesus is comparing the Pharisees and their traditions and their ideas to the old wineskins, right? So, because they've come to him and they say, look, you're not fasting, you're not doing things. Look, they fast and they fast, but you're not doing it right. And Jesus says, well, you can't put a new wine in an old wineskin. So, they must be the old wineskins, right? Everybody with me so far? And their wineskins are kind of fixed. They're already, you know, a certain size and shape, and they're not flexible. So if you try to put the new wine in there, it's going to break it. But this must represent their whole view of things. Like they had this very rigid view, you have to wash your hands, you have to do this fasting thing, you have to, and half of it was wrong. But that was fixed in their minds, and they couldn't get around that. Like an old wineskin that's taken on its shape, and it's not flexible anymore. But Jesus is coming. He's bringing something new. What's he bringing that's new? It's his whole doctrine. It's his teaching. And in fact, he said, we saw earlier, he's the fulfillment of the Isaiah prophecy that he's come to set the captives free and to bring liberty. And so Jesus is coming to set them free from all kinds of things. He's going to set them free from the yoke of the law. He's going to set them free from all of these traditions that they had been bound by and had piled up on top of the law, which he said was a burden that no one could bear. He's going to set them free from all that, in addition to setting them free from their sins. And in fact, they haven't even seen anything yet, because they don't even know that soon they're going to find out the Gentiles are also welcome in, and you don't even have to be circumcised in the kingdom that he's ushering in. So their whole world, which I think is represented by this old wineskin, it could not contain the new wine of the teaching of Jesus, of what it means to live the life of a Christian. That could not exist inside the confines of their own rigid, view of things that have to be the old way. The other part of this is that Jesus says, no one, after having the old, prefers the new, because he says the old is better. And I think that's a statement on human nature, that generally speaking, people like the old things better. And just think about how that applies. People always talk about the good old days, the way it ought to be. Things aren't made like they used to be. We like things the way they have been and the way they are. And change is difficult. Even if they rearrange stuff in Walmart, what happens? You know, it's like everybody's like, why? I knew where it was, but now it's somewhere else. Or if we paint the outside of the building, you can be sure there's going to be like, I don't know. I kind of thought it looked nice the way it used to be. We get things in our mind like, this is the way it's always been. I can picture that from when I was a kid. It's always been that way. Why does it need to be different? I like the way it was. I'm used to that. It's comfortable, right? So for the Pharisees, what was comfortable, what they were used to, their whole view of like how you do religion, Jesus' teaching is not going to fit in that. But they would still kind of prefer the old. They kind of liked the old. So they were going to have to be dragged a little bit into, if they would even accept it, the new way, as is typically the case for people. So I really think that is the meaning of this parable, these three parables really, as it relates to their question. And then the question becomes, what does that have to do with you and me today as Christians? Because obviously this was originally stated to Jews because of their own kind of thing. And does this have any bearing or any application for a modern believer? And I think the answer is yes. And I think we see it spelled out for us in Colossians chapter 2. Let's go over there. The fact is, because it's kind of a human nature thing, that it wasn't just the Pharisees who would try to force Jesus and his followers into the old wineskins of their traditions and their misconceptions. That's something that people often do. And so we see here in Paul writing to the Christians in Colossae, in verse 8 of Colossians 2, "See to it that no one takes you captive by philosophy, empty deceit, according to human tradition, according to the elemental spirits of the world, and not according to Christ." He warns them that someone might come in and take you captive, and they're going to do that using things like philosophy, deception, and even tradition. And then, as an example of that, skip down to verse 20. "If with Christ you died to the elemental spirits of the world," in other words, you've been set free, "why, as if you were still alive in the world, do you submit to regulations, do not handle, do not taste, do not touch, referring to things that perish as they are used, according to human precepts and teachings? These indeed have an appearance of wisdom in promoting self-made religion and asceticism and severity to the body, but they are of no value in stopping the indulgence of the flesh." That asceticism and severity is like afflicting yourself and denying yourself and causing discomfort. And this is very similar, I think, to the Jews' notion of if you're fasting, you've got to afflict yourself and you've got to look miserable. And this is how you know you're doing it right, when you're really, when you're really making it hard on yourself and everybody can see that, oh, this is a righteous person. And he says those things have this, in verse 23, and have an appearance of wisdom. It kind of looks wise. And all these rules that they pile up and try to bind you with and take you captive with, hey, you can't do that, and you have to do this, you have to wash your hands, and you're not allowed to do that, and you must do this. But it's not stuff that comes from Christ. These are things that come to, he says in verse 22, human precepts and teachings. Because of human nature, I think we'll always have a tendency to do that. There's going to be traditions. This is just how it's always been. My grandmother did it this way. My mom did it. My dad did it this way. This is how it's been for as long as I can remember. And you better do it too. Well, make sure that whatever this thing is that we're trying to enforce on everybody else is actually the Word of God. Or is it just human precepts? Is it just traditions? Is it just the way I'm used to? Because if it is, then I've become kind of like that old wineskin that's saying, you've got to fit into here, and I'm not willing to give. I'm not willing to be flexible. But the teaching of Christ, it brings this liberty, and it is not something that has to be kept in or stored in or confined by our own, traditions and misconceptions and preconceptions. But it is something that we should, the only thing we should bind on each other is what the Lord has revealed and what the Lord has taught. And above and beyond that, there is freedom in Christ. And Paul is warning them here, don't let someone take that away from you. Don't submit to it. You've been set free. Don't let somebody come along and start laying these rules on you that just come from their own human ideas, that come from the philosophy, that have some appearance of wisdom or the appearance of godliness, but don't come from the Lord himself. So I believe that's how this would apply to us today. Let's just consider a few lessons to take away from this. Number one of the Pharisees' downfall was that they just worshiped for show. Right? We've seen that. We don't want to ever be guilty of that. We should worship in sincerity and truth, or else it doesn't count for anything. So if we're doing stuff just to make sure everybody sees that I'm one of the good guys, if that's my aim, to just impress other people, Jesus says they have their reward. That's all you're going to get out of it. It doesn't please God. Number two, fasting is a good thing, but Jesus shows that fasting was not necessarily to be done ritually, but was to be done when the occasion called for it. Fasting was something that was often done privately, and it was something that you might not even know that somebody is fasting. But fasting was associated with prayer, with earnest appeal to God. And, you know, it's not something like the others that was to be done for show. And it's not necessarily something that should be done just as a ritual, which is what the Jews had done, and also something to try to impress other people. Also, I think another interesting point about that is Jesus says when the bridegroom is with them, there's no need for fasting and all that, but he'll be taken away. But here's a cool thing to think about. He's coming back, right? And so when the bridegroom returns, there'll be no more need for fasting. There'll be no more need for mourning. There'll be no more need for grieving. When Jesus was with his people, they were rejoicing. And one day, when we're all together again and Jesus is with us and in our midst, there will be no more need for grieving or mourning or any of those things, but it'll be a time for rejoicing. That's something to look forward to. And then finally, of course, as it relates to this wineskins, don't let traditions prevent you from accepting and living in the gospel of our Lord, and certainly don't be guilty of trying to enforce your traditions or ideas on other Christians as if that comes from the Lord himself. This is what we have to live and abide by. Perhaps there's someone here this morning who has something in your life that you need to make right. We always want to offer that opportunity to you, and if we can be of assistance, let us know as we stand and sing.